I'd like to start tonight's talk with a story given by a music producer, John Diaz. It's a true story. This was in 2007. He said, a few years earlier, John was on a flight taking off from Taiwan when things went horribly wrong. Before his flight even left the runway, it was hit with two serious collisions, including one that ripped a hole in the plane, causing the cabin to fill with fiery jet fuel. John watched the people around him ignite in flames. Miraculously, he found a way to survive. Thanks to his quick thinking and having a seat in the front row, John was able to shield himself with a leather carry-on bag and escape through an exit door. Before he got out, John saw the people around him strapped into their seats, burning. As he watched, he says he noticed what appeared to be auras leaving their bodies. Some brighter than others. I had an instant knowing, he said. The brightness and dimness of the auras were how one lives one's life. That's one of the major things that really has changed for me. I want to live my life so that my aura, when it leaves, is very bright. It's a tragic story, but also inspirational in a way. Inspirational in that all of us who are here on some level are working on brightening our energy field, our auras, our spirits, whatever you want to call this energy that is us. So tonight I'm going to talk about how to meet our suffering with resiliency such that we are actually brightening our energy fields and not darkening them. But even with this greatest intention, you know, life is quite the predicament. Our parents left us with this amazing legacy with their combined ancestral pain that they inherited from all their ancestors encoded in our DNA. Did you know that our ancestors' trauma and joy is encoded in our DNA? That's what they're coming out with now, that we're actually born with the trauma of our ancestors. And I don't know what to say about that other than thanks a lot. Wow, as if life isn't hard enough, now I have to deal with your trauma too. So we have the trauma we're born with, and then our parents, being that they haven't, most of our parents, caregivers, whoever took care of us, most of them struggled and blundered through trying to deal with life because they had their own trauma that they didn't know how to deal with, that they inherited. Right, so on top of the inherited trauma, we also have their trauma with their behavior and their conditioning. So we were conditioned from a very young age. And most of that conditioning, I have to say, at least mine and most people that I meet, their conditioning and their trauma has taught them to fear life, that life is something to be feared. And that the world is a dangerous place. You have to be careful, extra careful. You can't trust anyone, or not many people at least. And if you came from my family, you have to work hard to survive. Anybody came from a similar family? Oh, we were born together, we were raised together. It's not just that it's hard to survive. You have to work hard to survive. Right, so it was all about survival. And society all around us kind of shares the same mindset. And so even if we didn't get it growing up, we'll get it through the prevalent mind stream around us. One of my favorite expressions I saw once, and I say it often, is, "My life has a superb cast, but I can't figure out the plot." It's so true. You know, when it comes right down to it, we really don't know what the deal is. Right? We don't know what the goal of this whole life thing is. We have intuitions that are pulling us in direction of the man to get a brighter aura. But we really don't know. It's like being born and into this life. We don't know why we're here. We're told that there's this great journey called life that we're supposed to win at somehow, but we don't know what winning even looks like. We don't know what the destination is supposed to look like. And we have no roadmap. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, and being raised by an incredibly clueless parents who gave us their idea of what the destination point's supposed to be, and their roadmaps were not maybe the same ones we want to use. You know? So here we have these two objectives together in life. The one is we want to heal our trauma, heal our, you know, this trauma in our DNA, heal ourselves. And then we also want to figure out this journey and to maximize this journey. And that's a lot of what this path is about. And yet we've also experienced, had fleeting moments, maybe even years or a lifetime full of joy, caring, deep wisdom, beauty. And these moments call to us. And during these moments, we realize we're not alone, that we're interconnected, and we're all part of this web of interconnection, a very beautiful, peaceful, and loving place. And that's our true nature. And we realize that it's all of our true nature. And we're drawn to our true nature, like moths are drawn to a beacon of light. We know that. We feel it intuitively. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? And it brings us to practice. It brings us here for 4 days. I remember being in a retreat, walking back and forth. And I look up and everybody looks like zombies. You know, they're all looking down, lifting, swinging, placing. And I thought, what the hell? Well, this is crazy. What am I doing here? You know, so for anybody felt that doubt before? Yeah, and then I realized, oh, this is doubt. This is doubting mind. And then went back to my lifting, swinging, placing. But it really is a strange thing that we're doing here. Sitting and watching our breath and being aware of the moment and bringing loving kindness to our bodies and our experience. And it works. It really does. It, just speaking from experience. But how do we reconcile these two completely polar opposite truths? One is that the world is a dangerous place and we have to survive. That's on one end. And this is true in the egoic realm, is it not? The world is somewhat of a dangerous place. We don't know when the nuclear button is going to get pressed any minute. People that are leading this world. So danger and trying to survive on one end. And on the other is this oneness and this love and this peace and this knowing our true nature. How do we reconcile these two? The egoic realm and the realm of the spirit or super mundane realm, whatever you want to call it, the unconditioned. So when we put all of our emphasis on the egoic realm. The egoic realm's foundation is on fear and competition and survival and disconnection. So if we're too much over into the egoic realm, we're going to become very fearful and disconnected, lost. On the other hand, if we're going to be all the way over in the spiritual realm, spending all of our time in bliss and meditation, that can be troubling as well. Because we can become disconnected from other people if we're in this blissful meditative state all the time. We might not be able to take care of ourselves because we're not taking care of our egoic material realm that needs to be taken care of. right? We can become really disconnected from other people and kind of get into this place of needing to ward off other people. Going to go off into my cave and be spiritual being and ignore and avoid everyone because it's just too painful. They're stuck in the egoic realm, right? So there's a painful disconnection when we go too far off into the spiritual as well. And there's a lot of spiritual bypassing that happens when we get stuck in the spiritual realm. We just want to avoid all difficulties. Just stay in this bliss, and I'm just not going to deal with these difficult energies that might arise. So what to do? Jack and I are going to be continually pointing to the middle ground, the one that takes care of the egoic realm, that honors the egoic realm, that faces the trials and tribulations and these energies that are there to be healed in this realm, this earthly realm, without denying, without pretending, without contorting the truth, right? Without running away from things, and also without getting lost in the difficulties and the challenges. So there's a middle ground there in the egoic realm. And when we want to bring in the spiritual realm as well, right? There's a middle ground between the egoic and the spiritual realm. We can't be too much on one side, too much on the other, because we do have to exist as human beings in this world. And by the way, you will get much further if you're balanced between those two. Any out of balance in those two in your spiritual practice is going to come to a dead halt. Truly. And from this middle ground, you'll be able to tap into the totality of who you are. Because you are earthly. And you're also spirit. And you're going to be able to tap into this richness that's rooted in the present moment. This depth, this beauty, this peace. Where the mystery of life is unfolding moment to moment to moment. And you get to be part of that. Not fight it, but actually welcome that. So how many here would agree with me to say that most of our fellow human beings, including ourselves from time to time, get totally lost in the egoic realm? It's easy to do. It's really easy to do. It's easy to get lost in fear, denial, and desperately hold on to what we've accumulated in our lives with fear that someone was going to take it away. I've heard several stories from people that I deeply care about who've had to deal with other family members fighting over inheritance when their parents die. And not even speaking to each other during this battle for possessions. Very painful. And then other people, because they can't handle all this fighting, infighting in the egoic realm, might do the opposite, where they become complacent, depressed, and totally withdraw. So what do we need in order to bring balance in the egoic realm is resilience. Resilience is what's needed to navigate this earthly egoic realm in particular. The definition of resilience is the power of or the ability to return to your original form or your original position after being bent, compressed, stretched, or the elasticity. So you have elasticity. It's the ability to recover quickly or readily from illness, depression, adversity. And this is really important to have resiliency, and I'm going to tell you three primary points which the rest of my talk is going to be focused on with adversity. Three primary points that I think are very helpful to accept and understand. And the first point, and then I'm just going to say what they are, and then I'm going to go deep within each one and explore them from a Buddhist and practice perspective. So the first one is to accept that adversity will happen. We should change the t-shirt to adversity happens. Did you get that? Yeah, okay. Not everyone has my sense of humor, I realize. I say things I think are hilarious and people are like going, okay, that's all right. As long as I'm amusing myself, right? Yeah, adversity will happen. You can't avoid adversity. The second truth or fact primary point that I'm going to talk about today is that we can live wisely to limit unneeded adversity. So not all of our adversity is needed. And I guess you can probably guess the third one is how to work skillfully with adversity when it's present or when it happens. And work skillfully such that you don't so that the adversity doesn't destroy us, right? But it actually strengthens us and gives us more resiliency and greater wisdom. So the first fact and truth is that adversity will happen. Can anybody deny this? Anybody here never had adversity? Right? So one day you're going to wake up and your car is not going to work, or you might have a flat tire, or you might wake up and be sick and have a health problem, or you wake up one day and you've lost someone you love. These things are going to happen. You can't avoid all difficulties. You can minimize them, but you can't get rid of them. And I don't think you can be a human being in a human body in this human culture without dealing with challenges and difficulties. It's just impossible. So we want to bring in resiliency, which helps us spring back from these difficulties when they happen. From a Buddhist standpoint, adversity is called, anybody know? Dukkha, right? And dukkha translates D-U-K-K-H-A into stress, dissatisfaction, suffering, discontent, or wow, this really sucks, or this is really hard. And this is where the Buddha started his teachings. He started his teachings with dukkha. He said, I teach two things. I teach suffering and the end of suffering. I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. In mindfulness teachings as well, suffering or stress or pain is a fact of life. So we know it's a fact of life, right? And yet, here's the conundrum. We live as if adversity is not supposed to happen, right? Don't we just assume the day's going to go good? And when things go bad or wrong, we get stressed. We get frustrated. Why is this happening? So we live as if difficulties are not supposed to happen, and yet they're a fact of life. They will happen. They're an inherent part of life. And this is where we get at war with our experience, at odds with the moment, right? If we can accept that adversity is going to happen, dukkha is going to happen from time to time, then we'll have a more balanced state of mind to deal with it when it does arise, right? Because we don't want the resistance to the difficulty. We don't want to start that war. It's an inner war. It's very painful. It's unpleasant. And yet we learn from recent brain science over the last couple of decades that the human brain is reflectively programmed to avoid the unpleasant and seek the pleasant. So we're wired to do this. We're wired to avoid the unpleasant, seek the pleasant, which was great for our survival as a human species, right? For this adaptive survival mechanism. But it's terrible for leading a stress-free life with internal peace. This constant desire to avoid discomfort and seek pleasures colors our experience. It's constantly coloring your experience. Have you noticed that today? Right? At all? And because that this wiring is going on in our brains, what it can do is it can lead us with this constant sense of dissatisfaction. Like even when we feel great peace, there can be this intuition that comes up, oh, something's not right. Something's wrong. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Yeah, something's not right, or something is missing. I can't put my finger on it. I don't know what it is, but something's missing, right? We're wired to be like this, to feel like this. And it's really important to be able to see when it's at this really subtle level. It's much easier to see when we're really stressed out. But the Buddha taught us that freedom from this inner angst, this dissatisfaction, is possible. And he called it awakening or nibbana. It's interesting teaching Buddhist teachings today to the modern world. And what I found is that most people, not all, but most people don't have a very realistic relationship with awakening. Right? Our freedom from suffering is what awakening is. You're no longer dissatisfied or suffering. Most Americans either have this fantasy view of enlightenment, like they're supposed to wake up one day and be totally blissful and blissed out for the rest of their life, and they keep waiting for this bliss to happen. Or they have this view where they just can't even relate to the concept of enlightenment or awakening as even a possibility. And because it doesn't even feel like a possibility, they don't even want to go there. Freedom from suffering, freedom from stress, just feels like too much of a ask. But most of us can relate to reducing our stress and suffering and becoming happier. Anybody? So if that helps you to be able to hold dukkha in a different frame, to reframe it, that might be helpful. I know that it's helped me bring a lot more peace and joy, meaning, depth, richness to life. I've really benefited a lot from it. It's especially helped me accept circumstances, present circumstances as they are. So there are two primary forms of dukkha that are taught. There are a lot of them, but two primary forms of suffering. There's mental suffering, and then there's physical suffering. And we can do some things to reduce physical suffering, like taking better care of our bodies, getting good sleep, eating really healthily, meditating regularly. Studies show that if you have pain, it's 40% reduction in pain from daily meditation practice. Yeah. But you can't reduce all of your physical suffering. The body's still going to decline, and someday it's going to die. But a lot of teachers teach that all of our suffering is actually mental suffering. Because physical pain in and of itself is not the suffering. It's just pain. It's our reaction to the physical pain. It's our relationship with the physical pain that makes it suffering, right? It's our aversion to it, wanting to get rid of it, not wanting it to be here. And since we don't have much leverage over physical suffering, we do have a lot of leverage over mental suffering. And that's what the Buddha was pointing to, how to reduce our mental suffering. So that's that suffering is inevitable, number one. Number two, rooting out and stop creating avoidable adversity. Stop creating avoidable adversity and mental suffering. They found these quotes. These little kids thought they were writing letters to God. And this little boy, Larry, he says, "Dear God, maybe Cain and Abel would not have killed each other if they had had their own rooms. That's what my mom did for me and my brother. Right? Maybe we need separate rooms. A little bit of common sense here. But I realize that I suffer and I get stressed and dissatisfied every single time I can't accept present circumstances the way they are. I don't want them to be this way. I want them to be differently. Right? That's when we go into forcing, controlling, getting angry, judging. Right? Get upset. It's really difficult. So that's the one thing to do is to just put a flag on, beware every time you're dissatisfied. You want things to be different. Well, hello, this is the way they are right now. Right? So there's a certain level of acceptance that has to happen. Okay, I have a preference, but right now this is how it is. Can I accept this? So that'll help us reduce a lot of our mental suffering. Avoid mental suffering. I talk a lot about trauma. Yeah, trauma. I think our world is addicted to trauma. Anything you turn on the TV, it's some big drama. Our video games are getting more dramatic and more real and more violent. Everything is getting bigger. Restaurants, I used to run Subway restaurants, they're saying that by 2050 they'll all have to be double deckers. Hello, double decker Subway restaurants? But yeah, everything's very dramatic. And we're constantly stimulated by input, you know, through the news media and internet and noise pollution is going up exponentially. Right? And I think from this overstimulated place, it's easy to get really attached to drama, right? Such that if someone comes walking in and says, I can't believe she said or he did, and the first thing, what do we normally do? Run over, who said what? You know, yeah, so a lot of my practice has been in not needing to get involved in people's negative traumas. If it's mine to get involved in it, obviously, you know, something's happening that includes me. Maybe my behavior was unskillful and I need to clean it up. That's one thing. Or someone is really harming me and I need to handle it. That's one thing. But most of the traumas out in our society are not things that we need to get involved in. Does anybody know what I'm saying? If there's something we can do about it, do something. Otherwise, keep cultivating wholesome qualities that we can cultivate within ourselves. We might need to reduce some negative input. Maybe not have our phone beep at us every time a new something that our president tweeted, just tweeted, or whatever your negative input is. Maybe you can reduce that a little bit. Not get involved in all these traumas. We need to constantly be creating circumstances like our stretching, where you bring a balming, healing, calm, relaxing situation to your nervous system. The nervous system is not designed to handle constant stress, constant stimulation. We're not wired that way. It's really unhealthy for our minds, for our hearts, for our bodies, for everything. So constantly looking at how can we bring more balance to our bodies, to our hearts, to our, you know, putting ourselves and our mental health first. Doesn't mean that we don't care. It doesn't mean that we're not going to be engaged. But looking at our relationship to, are we creating unneeded suffering for ourselves and others too? Because others get to hear about our suffering. this last weekend, my parents have a guest house, and I rent out their guest house for Airbnb. And this woman, I knew she was going to be a pain from the get-go because she started texting me 2 weeks before she came. Just want to let you know I'm excited about coming in 2 weeks. I'm like, yep, all right, here we go. And then the first night they were there, she sent me like 5 texts, and I was out with friends eating dinner and going to a movie. My phone's turned off, and when I got home, I saw all these frantic texts from her. There are bugs taking over the window in this guest bedroom. We vacuumed all up, but no one can sleep in this room. We need someone to come here right away, and blah, 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 demanding refunds, all this. So she kept sending me all these crazy texts. So I sent the next morning, I sent the cleaners who live right near the house to go look at it. And she said, there was one stink bug in the windowsill. You know the stink bugs? The armored-looking brown bugs? They're prolific at this time of year. Anyhow, but the other woman was, I said, well, she said, nobody can sleep in that room, so we need a discount, because that's one whole room we can't sleep in. And I kept getting all these texts. I started suffering. I was, like, getting angry. I was like, she's trying to get money back. I know that what she's doing over a stink bug. Anyhow, and then I realized whenever I start mental suffering like that, I get to look at what am I clinging to? What am I attached to that I can let go of? I realized I was clinging to not wanting to give this woman a discount because I didn't feel like she deserved one because she'd already been such a pain. Right, so I got to let that go. Oh, shoo, what a relief. As soon as I let go and I called her and I said, well, first I said, can you please send me pictures of the infestation? Because I've had so many people, which I have, try to get discounts for, you know, there are people like that out there who will just try to get discount. They search the house for anything that they can say, I want a discount because this, whatever. Anyhow, so she sent me a picture. It was 3 stink bugs. And I'll get off of this story. But it doesn't it stink? Anyhow, 3 stink bugs. And she took the picture of these 3 stink bugs from like 4 different angles to show how many stink bugs there were of these 3 stink bugs. But I know the window. I know the colors of the room. I saw what she did. But it didn't matter. I just called her up and said, so what do you feel would be fair as a discount? And she said $70. And I said, okay, I'll mail you out $70. I'm sorry for your troubles. We'll keep an eye on that window, make sure that stink bugs don't collect there again. Have a great, safe flight back home. So it ended up being really great. You know, no more suffering for me. And she was happy too. But that's unnecessary suffering. So there's all suffering, all dukkha, is rooted in 3 primary mental defilements or taints. And these 3 primary roots are craving, greed, clinging, attachment. They all go in one craving pile. Craving for sensual pleasures is what the Buddha talked about a lot. That's lobha in Pali. The second category is hatred, anger, ill will, dosa. And the third category is ignorance or delusion, moha. And any time you're suffering or you're stressed or you're dissatisfied, it's rooted in one of these 3, and sometimes all 3 at once. That's a really painful experience. But our practice is cutting these roots, these defilements, these taints, right? That's our whole practice. And when we can cut this unnecessary mental suffering, when we cut these taints, then we can be much happier. Yes, did you have your hand up? Fear is aversion. which is the anger and ill will. Aversion goes in with anger and ill will. Yeah, thank you. So here's a sutta that the Buddha taught that I think is great with dealing with mental defilements. It's called Sabbasawa Sutta. It's in the Middle Discourses. It's called All the Taints. And taints are these mental defilements. They're also called cankers and influxes and difficulties. So I'm just going to read to you a little bit about what the Buddha said. He said, the destruction of these mental taints is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. When one attends unwisely, unarisen taints will arise and increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen taints do not arise, and arisen taints dissolve. Right? So how are we holding? How are we going to bring our energy to these taints, which are called asawa in Pali? So he went on to say that these taints, these mental defilements, can be abandoned by doing seven different things. And I'm going to talk about each one briefly, what he said, what he taught. And these apply to the second and third categories of avoiding unnecessary defilements and then also dealing with suffering when it's unavoidable. Okay, so the first way to abandon mental defilement is by seeing, S-E-E-I-N-G. And what the Buddha taught is that one sees clearly what is fit for one's attention and what is unfit for one's attention. Right? So when someone's embroiled in their own drama, trauma, if we're seeing properly, we're going to see that that's not something that we necessarily need to get involved in. It's not fit for our attention. Right? Things fit for your attention, the Buddha went out to point out that dharma, anything having to do with your dharma, your practice, unattached awareness to the present moment, the arising and falling away of suffering, so you want to see suffering as it's arising and then passing away, and then also wholesome states. So these are things that are worth your attention, worth your seeing. Things unfit for attention, self-view, federa views, who I was in a past life, who I'll be in a future life, who I was in the past, any attention given to craving for sense pleasures, anger, fear, aversion, ill will, or ignorance. And I'm going to clarify what he's saying is attachment to these things, getting lost in them, getting caught in them. One understands that when one understands that one is always cultivating something. We're always cultivating something, right? When we get lost in these energies, we're strengthening them, we're cultivating more fear. When we can see it clearly, hold it with wise attention, with mindful awareness, with compassion, then there's no aversion there. There's no hatred, no ill will. It will dissipate. So that's the first one, by seeing. The second one is by restraining. One restrains the eye faculty, the ear faculty, the nose, tongue, body, and mind. So the Buddha talked a lot about setting mindful guards at the doors of your senses to make sure that you don't get carried away in craving for sense pleasures by hearing something, smelling something, tasting something, touching something. So that's by restraining. The third one is by using. Using things wisely, having a wise relationship with our things. He went on to say, you use clothes only for protection and from the elements, for heat and for modesty. You use food for sustenance and good health so that you can have a strong body for, guess what? Practicing. He was an intense dude, wasn't he? And not using clothes or food for amusement or physical beauty. You use resting places for protection and for practicing. Right? And you use medicine for good health. But he's saying when you have a healthy relationship with these needed requisites, then you're not going to get caught up in feverish mental taints, defilements. So that's by using. The fourth one is by enduring. One practices patience and bears cold, heat, hunger, thirst, bugs, wind, sun, ill-spoken words, bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing. Wasn't he intense? So basically what he's saying is when you're, that you endure these things. You don't react to them. You don't strengthen them by getting angry and you don't let them stop you from practicing. Oh, I had pain in my back. I can't meditate. It's too cold. I can't meditate. Right? So he's saying you would endure these things and you keep practicing anyhow. The fifth one is by avoiding. One avoids dangerous animals, brambles, a cliff, a cesspit, a sewer. This is where it gets interesting for us, I think. One avoids unsuitable seats, associating with the unwise, or companions who engage in unwholesome behavior. So no taints will arise in the minds of one who avoids. So he's saying, who are your companions? Hang out with wise people. Don't hang out with unwise people. And don't put yourself in danger, right? Avoid dangers. What would we say to avoid today in modern society? Everything. Thank you, Jack. Netflix. Yeah, Facebook. All right, the sixth one is by removing. Yes. Yes. Yeah, he's saying to avoid associating with them. You know, I don't think we avoid them completely, but we just don't spend a huge chunk of our time with them. Yeah. And you know, this is for, he was an intense guy. He's saying enlightenment in 6 months. Here, this is what you do, or 6 years. Right? And we each have to look at our own relationship to our friends and our relationships. If someone is constantly draining us, we're constantly feeling troubled, or the three roots, you know, anger, aversion, ill will, or confusion, all of that, that might be not someone we want to hang out with very often. The sixth one is by removing. He gets just more and more intense, let me tell you. He says, one does not tolerate thoughts of sensual desire. One abandons them, removes them, does away with them, annihilates them. Likewise, one does not tolerate thoughts of ill will or cruelty. Right? So we pay attention to what's happening. We just... basically, he's saying, don't spend your time focusing on these things, right? Don't even give them the energy. These taints of the mind will be avoided by removing them. The seventh one is by developing. Reflecting wisely, one develops the seven factors of enlightenment. So I don't have time to go into all of them, but these are the things you're wanting to cultivate. Mindful awareness. It's an enlightenment factor. That's what we're doing here. Investigation, looking clearly, seeing clearly what your experience is. We're doing that here too as well. Energy, we're bringing energy to our practices. Are you guys doing that? Joy, opening to, looking for joy when it's present. Tranquility, that's the peace of mind that we're developing. concentration, you're developing concentration in your practice, and equanimity. Every time you can turn towards your experience with a balanced state of mind, you're cultivating equanimity. And guess what you can do to develop every single one of these factors? Practice, meditate, formal meditation practice. And of course informal, but especially formal. When these factors ripen within oneself, all these mental defilements are removed by developing. All right. Isn't that a great sutta? I thought so. So we want to learn how to work skillfully with the unavoidable adversity, one of the ones that are going to happen. I saw this bumper sticker once, and I say it a lot too. Some days you're the bug, some days you're the windshield. See, you guys aren't laughing. You know, some guy who just took one of my classes came to me, and we went over equanimity, and he said, "This was such perfect timing for me. I really needed to hear this. I've been struggling." He said, my mother is not doing well. She may die. And my sister, who's taking care of my mother's husband, just died suddenly last week. And she's really struggling. And he said, and I'm all the way over here, and I can't leave to go support them because they're over in California. And he said, and guess where they are? Sonoma. And they've just had to leave their home, which they're not sure if it's burned down or not. Did this guy ask for all this stuff to happen in his family's life? No, but he loves them. So he said this talk of equanimity and learning how to meet adversity with a balanced state of mind and acceptance is what I really need to hear right now. With mindful awareness, we see where we're clinging, where we're attached, how we create suffering for ourselves. Like I said, with the bugs, the stink bugs. And the more that we can turn towards our experience, the more resiliency we develop, the more we loosen our grip, and the more we're able to let go of things when they're happening, right? Let go of our death grip. Ajahn Chah, the Buddhist Thai master that a lot of teachers talk about, he has a quote that says, "If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will have complete peace." So a lot of our practice is letting go of the death grip of clinging and attachment, wanting things to be different, wanting them to be a certain way, accepting resiliency into our life, bringing resiliency forward. We can intentionally say, okay, resiliency, here we go. There's adversity here. Let's come forward. And understanding that suffering is the raw material for your awakening, right? Adversity is the raw material. You get to turn towards it, cultivate all these wholesome qualities, let go of all these unwholesome qualities, and take one step further to more peace and freedom and joy. It's a beautiful thing. The Tibetan Buddhist prayer says, "Grant that I may be given appropriate difficulties and sufferings on this journey so that my heart may be truly awakened and my practice of liberation and universal compassion may be truly fulfilled." So, in Tibetan, they pray for adversity. Please, come. I haven't quite gone that far. But if we can at least have an accepting and allowing relationship to adversity when it comes, that'll be a lot more helpful. Turning towards it, seeing what is there to learn, what wisdom is inherent in this difficulty. Yeah, there's always some more wisdom to gain. Is there something to let go of? Are we using some strategy that's not working and causing us stress? Maybe we want to let go of that strategy as a habit. And when we turn towards it, we have what are called insights. They're like bursts of energy and knowing and, oh, okay, the light turns on. And we're no longer struggling with that certain thing. Like I had the insight to let go of the whole bug thing. Oh, I don't have to suffer with this. And Jack is going to guide us in a compassion meditation later, because compassion is so needed when we're having a hard time or when someone else is having a hard time. It's our it's our healthy response to difficulties, right? And if we can have compassion for ourselves so we don't get stuck, and so many people are stuck in guilt and shame, right? They just feel guilty most of the time and they don't even know why. They need compassion. If we're stuck in guilt and shame, we need compassion. We need caring. We need support, right? Maybe stop isolating. Turn towards some supportive, caring spiritual people in your meditation or spiritual group. And of course, turning towards the good. I can't say this enough. There's a balance between opening and turning towards our suffering and opening to the good. We don't want to be at the exclusion of one or the other, right? But opening to the good and the beauty and the love and the peace, when it's there, brings amazing healing to the mind and the heart. So looking for the beauty. So turning towards your adversity, your difficulties, gaining more resilience when you do it, being kind to yourself, right? Having compassion for yourself and others. We're not going to handle all diversities as well as we would like to. So can we forgive ourselves and be kind to ourselves when we're not as skillful as we can be? Well, we can choose to be more skillful the next time, right? And the deeper and the richer we go in this practice, the more wisdom will unfold, so that the less we're going to struggle each time. And someday we'll be able to look back and say, wow, this used to drive me crazy, and now I'm just laughing at it. And as we do this, we start to open to this inner light, this aura, our true nature. Every time we can be with our experience, whether it's positive or negative or neutral, in a deep and profound accepting way, our true nature is there for us to tap into. It's a beautiful thing, and it's found in this moment. And it's who we are. Here's a quote or a poem by John Austin. It's called Awareness. Her gaze is so constant, our every move watched with such affection, a ceaseless vigil without condition or agenda, silent, patient, unrelenting in her embrace. There is endless room in the heart of this lover, infinite space for whatever foolishness we may toss her way. But she is also crafty, this one, a thief who will steal away everything we ever cherished, all of our beliefs, our ideas, our philosophies, until nothing is left but her shimmering wakefulness, this simple love for what is.